Well, last night we left off in kind of a tense moment, so maybe you didn't sleep very well because you were just, what is going to happen here? This castle has been besieged by the land, which was, of course, Mary Queen of Scots' mother. I can't confuse you because there's so many Marys here, but Mary Queen of Scots' mother, the Queen Regent. Mary Queen of Scots is still a young woman and not quite ready to rule. She's going to come on over in a little bit here from France, where she's getting indoctrinated in French Roman Catholicism and decadence in the French court. And what's more, the Queen Regent had sent, you know, dispatches to France asking for the French Navy to be sent over to lay siege to the castle from the seaside. Here, it's a little bit hard. If I go back one, you can see behind, I have one of my students went on to say, actually two of them went on to St. Andrew's University, and this one was there at the time. And if you wear your red robe, you can get in free to any of the admittance things. So he wore his red robe that day, so we didn't have to pay his way into the castle again. and he now actually married a Brit, and he actually teaches Latin in an English grammar school. But in the background, you can see the sea. That's the North Sea. So picture in your mind, July of 1548, and you've got 21 French galleys, but warships, big cannons, big guns trained on you. And this is a group of very zealous young men. It's been fortified now, and they're going to do their best. Knox is there among them, not in the capacity of a soldier, but in the capacity of a chaplain, where he was declaring Christ, the strength of his death and the power of his resurrection, preaching daily in the castle. Now, this all took a number of months. We kind of think of this happening in a few weeks, maybe, and all, but it was a number of months before finally the French army got over there. Things happened faster in the modern world, but in those days it moved more slowly. Knox even went out into the town. I mean, this wasn't a siege where he couldn't do that. And he had a debate in the town with one of the Roman Catholic preachers, friars there. So there was a lot more openness. But by the time they got the siege fully underway, these guys were holed up in the castle. In fact, there's mining going on. The French troops of the Queen Regent, really Scotland was under siege of all along for decades by the French. They were mining underneath, trying to undermine the walls and make their way in. And inside, these guys started countermining and digging out. You can actually go down into those mines today, which, by the way, is where I got the idea for the subterranean episodes in Duncan's War, if you're familiar with that first book in the Crown of Covenant trilogy. I see a few of you responding there. It's from being down in the mines at St. Andrew's Castle. I got all the ideas for that. So it's a real place. You could be there right now. Scary stuff, though, because what happens if you break out underneath the castle and here's the bad guys on the other side? You know, you have this little squabble underground, which would be more than a little squabble. long story short, the castle falls, and Knox and the rest of these young men are taken prisoners. They didn't know what was going to happen. Are they going to be executed right on the site? On site? Are they going to hang them all? What are they going to do? but they didn't. They needed horsepower for their ships. The English have a saying that he who sails without oars stays on good terms with the wind. The French didn't have that saying, and neither did the Spanish. And they still used slave labor. You know, you think about the Roman days, Ben-Hur and all that. Well, the French and the Spanish were still doing that. They would have sails and all, but when the wind wasn't favorable, they would crack the whip, quite literally, and the slaves, the galley slaves, would out oars and begin to row. Knox is going to be taken on the Nostradam, which was a coastal trading vessel. It wasn't a naval vessel. And he is going to be in down in the hold for 19 months with a number of other young men, Scots, many of them, but others too that would be taken in various other conflicts. There was never a shortage of slave labor in that world. It would almost kill him. And I want to say more about that actually in my sermon on Sunday morning because it's so relevant to the biblical text from Psalm 107 that we're going to be looking at, Lord willing, on the Lord's Day. So I'll give you more of the details of that, but for now we'll just kind of let that sit. February 1549, we have to get a little bit of English history to get the context here. Henry VIII died about 18 months before this, and his son, you know, this is a guy with six wives eventually, you know, by the end of his life, and the first three of his wives gave him offspring. The first was Catherine of Aragon. She was Spanish. What they did in those days is, you know, you didn't get to, if you were in high places, you didn't get to choose your mate. You didn't have any much say at all in it. And this led to all kinds of problems in court in those days. Typically your parents tried to get you matched up with another world power that was to the advantage of your country. You know, you would then end up having power and influence there, or maybe a war that had been going on for some time, or conflict between nations could be resolved by a marriage, you know, because marriage solves everything and there's never conflict. But anyway, that's kind of what they were thinking. So Henry VIII actually is second in line for the throne. And his brother, Arthur, they were hoping for Camelot, you know, bring peace after the War of the Roses and all internal civil war going on. At the end of that, they thought, you know, we'll name our son Arthur and he'll marry the Spanish princess, Catherine of Aragon, and we'll have peace with Spain, because those are the two big world powers that have been in conflict with each other. So Arthur gets married to Catherine in St. John the Evangelist Chapel, one of the most beautiful Romanesque, complete Romanesque chapels in Britain, that is the chapel of the Tower of London, which wasn't a place where you just hung on the wall in a dungeon. It was actually a royal residence. It had those kinds of dungeons too, but and all's going well for about 6 months until Arthur dies. And Henry VIII's still alive. So they've got to figure out what to do. So he moves to his son. They don't want to have to give the dowry for Catherine of Aragon back and send her back to Spain. So they say, just hold on here. We'll figure this out. You know, she's like in her mid-20s. And the next in line is Henry VIII, and he's 18. And he is the all-England wrestling champ. He's sort of the Renaissance prince. He writes poetry. He writes music. But he's a big, tough, strong guy, too. And all of this, quite well-educated. And they say, hey, show up at St. John the Evangelist Chapel next week because you're going to get married to Catherine of Aragon. You know? So that's marriage number one. So, you know, he's still responsible for his sin, but, you know, that's the setup. His first child by Catherine was, and there were multiple pregnancies and even live births for Bloody Mary, as she would come to be called. Mary the first would be the first child of Catherine of Aragon. She's off in Spain being trained to be a Spanish Roman Catholic and being trained in Spanish Renaissance decadence. So that's the setup right now. And when Henry VIII, who was sort of Protestant, he had some Protestant advisors around her, and he really didn't want to go the Roman Catholic thing because he had declared himself the head of the church. He didn't like the Pope being the head of the church. He wanted to be in charge. So he doesn't really want to go the whole Spanish Roman Catholic thing, so he doesn't want Mary, Bloody Mary, to succeed him. So he makes sort of a ipsa dixit, you know, declaration, fiat, you know, we're going to break all the rules here, and my firstborn is not going to be the next in line for the throne. It's going to be the child of my third wife. There's a second one in there, too. We'll meet her in a little bit. Her name is Anne Boleyn, and her child is Elizabeth. And Anne Boleyn was falsely accused by Henry of adultery and beheaded at the Tower of London. I think she was an earnest Christian, actually, by the accounts that we have of her own defense of her, the accusations against her and other things, too. But in any case, he doesn't want her offspring to be next in line. So he goes to the third, which also happens to be a boy. Jane Seymour had given birth to Edward. And then she dies from complications in the pregnancy. And so Edward is there. He's about 9 years old. And Henry VIII had died. Edward is a true believing young man. We get this from Knox's own accounts of preaching to him and having interaction with young Edward. So all that to say, Edward's advisors, he's still a fairly young man now, he's about 11, he's the age of my youngest son right now, and he's the king, which is a really scary thought when I think of Giles, King Giles. You know, he kind of thinks that way about himself sometimes and has to be brought down to a more proportionate size. But he has earnest Christian advisors around him. He has a chaplain named Hugh Latimer. He has a tutor who is an earnest, godly man, the Earl of Leicester et al. And so he's been nurtured in the gospel and in the word of God. And he's a king. So his advisors have been negotiating to get Knox, who had already come up on the English radar screen as a powerful preacher of the gospel. The word had gotten out from St. Andrew's Castle, even. And so they're negotiating to get these guys free. And in February of 1549, it happens. And Knox and some of the rest are sort of dumped off in the Thames estuary. And they're pretty sick. They're pretty worn out. They've got lashes on their back from the taskmaster beating away on them. And they have tummy aches. And most of them will have tummy aches for the rest of their life from parasites and all kinds of amoebas in the best of the worst food that they were getting. Right away, Latimer comes, hadn't met Knox before, but he'd heard all about him, and Hugh Latimer and Knox become fast friends, and in fact, later, Latimer would be called the Knox of England. Knox becomes the measure of your ability to preach and be an evangelist and train pastors and all the things that Knox, who really didn't have the training for this himself, but was empowered by the Spirit of God to do. You know, you can be a good evangelist, and we always hear about this, and then you don't disciple. You know, you can be a good evangelist and not disciple and then not train other leaders. And, well, Paul got it right under the power of the Holy Spirit in Ephesians chapter 4 and not be equipping the saints for the work of the ministry. But by the power of God and the purposes of God, Knox would do all of those things incredibly well. And he would give glory to God for all of that. Knox is called to preach. As soon as they can get him propped up, get some decent food in him, and get him feeling good enough, he's called to preach in high places in London. This is sophisticated London, and Knox, you have to understand, even today, how the English think about the Scots. I know there's a lot of Scots heritage here. I've heard some of your stories and all, and saw Mr. Gillis last night in that great kilt, and all. I was hoping he'd wear that today. So kind of disappointed, But the English basically look down on Scots today. A good friend of mine, Ian Hamilton, is the pastor of Cambridge Presbyterian Church, and he's a Scot, and he's proud of it, and he doesn't make any apologies for being a Scot. And he's in sophisticated Hall of Learning, Cambridge, England. All they have to do is listen to him preach once. And, you know, all that's put aside, and he ends up with professors and students and graduate students and all that clamor to hear that humble, godly, gifted man preach Jesus. He is just one of the most powerful Christ-centered preachers I've heard. But they look down typically at a Scot, and in Knox's day, all the more so. You know, this is a guy who didn't go to Cambridge or Oxford. I mean, you know, you're sunk already. He didn't even finish a degree at St. Andrews or Glasgow, which was it. And he's a complete nobody, as we saw last night. So there's something else going on here, isn't there? Cranmer, who's the Archbishop of Canterbury, now an Anglican Archbishop, with some problems that Knox is going to sniff out and bring to the surface here for what's going on in the Anglican Church. But they have him preach at All Hallows Bread Street, one of the most influential pulpits in London at the time. Can you imagine how hard it would be to concentrate on a sermon if you lived on All Hallows Bread Street? They called it that because there were all these amazing aromas of baking bread and pastries and all of that. I think I would have had a hard time sitting there. But he preaches there several times. Knox never, you know, fashioned his message for his audience. You know, he just preached straight stuff. I declare Jesus Christ, the strength of his death and the power of his resurrection. And he called a spade, a fig was Knox's approach. And he's doing this in sophisticated England, you know. and you'd think it wouldn't go well. It went well. It went very well. They asked him to preach some more. He preached in Westminster Abbey. He preached in the royal chapels of Windsor Castle and probably at the Tower of London and maybe others as well. He had multiple audiences with young Edward VI, so much so that he could make a real assessment of what was going on in that young man's heart and life. We'll see that here coming up in a little bit. And so Cranmer is working on the Book of Common Prayer at the time, which is going to cause a few problems when you get to the Crown and Covenant trilogy and the Covenanter era. Most of that, in terms of content, was because of revisions and semi-Pelagian revisions of that Book of Common Prayer. But initially, the Book of Common Prayer was a really solid document. The 39 articles that Cranmer, with the help of Ridley, Nicholas Ridley, who was the Bishop of London, and with Hugh Latimer and others, I don't think there would be anything that your pastors would not agree with in the 39 articles except ecclesiology, probably, and maybe a few of the wording things and wondering about what was going on there. But initially, those 39 articles are a solid gospel of grace, doctrines of grace. This is not some whacked out document. But Knox has a problem with where they're going on the Book of Common Prayer right off. And one of those problems, there were others, was that it prescribed kneeling in as the appropriate posture to take the Lord's Supper. And Knox is saying, wait a second, kneeling looks like worshiping something. And what was the whole problem with the Lord's Supper in the Middle Ages? Anybody know what the word, there's a big word here. It's kind of a Calvin and Hobbes word. It's like transubstantiation for Calvin and Hobbes is transmogrification or something like that. But, transubstantiation is that this bread, probably baked on All Hallows Bread Street, and this wine over here, definitely not made in England, it would have been made in France, become the body and the blood of Jesus. Mumbo jumbo, hoc est corpus meum, the priest says, and out pops the real body of Jesus, the real blood of Jesus. That's why you're on your knees when you take only the bread. You don't get the wine. The priest gets all the wine in the back room afterwards. You just got little crumbs of the bread. And Knox is saying, whoa, 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 whoa. That should not be the posture, kneeling. At the Last Supper, was that closest to the posture that those guys were in? Well, they were reclining because it was the ancient Near East. And that's what they did at meals. But they weren't kneeling. They weren't on their knees in prayer, devotion, adoration of the elements. He said, this is too confusing for people. And besides, your Reformation here in England is top down. It hasn't really been root and branch, the preaching of the gospel of grace, the power of the Spirit of God moving. It's been sort of a political top down deal. And most people are still Roman Catholic at the heart and really don't get the gospel. And you're trying to infuse all these really good sermons and prayers and things from the Book of Common Prayer into this mass population here. This is why Calvin would write to Cranmer, and he would say, Cranmer, you got to finish the Reformation. This is started, but it is not finished. And he would say, you need to do two things, Calvin would say in this. It's a great letter. You can read the letter to Cranmer. And Calvin says, you need to preach doctrine. The truths of the doctrines of grace and the gospel. We need to be hearing those. The people need to be hearing those so that the Spirit of God changes their hearts. You can't just tell them you're no longer Catholic, you are now Anglican. And people who are illiterate and, haven't been understanding a word in church suddenly are hearing things in English. That's good, But the priest giving them to them, because he has to, acts of uniformity, you have to read from the prayer book, might be a drunk Roman Catholic who got his position by nepotism or simony, not a real believer. Even by John Newton's day, he estimated of the 10,000 parishes in the Church of England, don't get me started on Anglicanism here, we'll be here for a month. But of the 10,000 parishes in the Church of England, 9,000 of them had unbelieving pastors. That's in the 1700s. In Knox's day, he's looking around, and most of the men installed in these pulpits would not have been true believers. They would have been, very, very deficient in their ability. That's what Cranmer knew that. That's why they had acts of uniformity, and you had to open the Book of Common Prayer, and you had to just read the homilies and read the prayers in English. You know, don't say anything else because you don't know what to say. So they're slurring through, bleary-eyed, through the liturgy, and there's no heart. So Calvin says, you've got to preach doctrine. You've got to train. And the second thing is you've got to train men who really know the gospel, who really know Jesus, who will then be installed as the pastors of the churches in England. What a concept, you know, that you would actually have a believing pastor. You know, so there's a lot of problems. Knox is not a guy to sit back when there's lots of problems and say, okay, you know, that's fine. Knox talks about it. Knox preaches about it. Knox calls a spade, and a fig, a fig. And it's getting a little inconvenient. Thomas Cranmer, good man, but I think a man of his day, too, and of the particular problems in high places in England, he thinks, okay, well, maybe I should get rid of Knox. You know, we'll install him in another pulpit. Let's get him out of London. How about Bishop of Rochester? We'll make you Bishop of Rochester. And Knox says, I don't believe in bishops. I certainly don't want to be a bishop. Yeah. Oh, there's another problem. And Knox says, and by the way, can we go back to that kneeling in taking the Lord's Supper? And finally, Cranmer says, okay, I'll put in a little footnote, a rubric. Knox calls it the black rubric. And it's going to say, it's a little footnote in the liturgy, and it's going to say, oh, and by the way, I'm paraphrasing here. By the way, when you're kneeling and you're taking the bread and the wine, you shouldn't think that you're actually venerating the host. You know, that you're actually worshiping things. And Knox looks at that and says, why shouldn't they think that? I mean, that's exactly the posture you put them in to think that. You know, so Cranmer's thinking, okay, this is not going real well. Hugh Latimer and Knox are really getting along. They're doing really well because Hugh Latimer had a lot of the same concerns about the Anglican Church and where it's going. So they're frustrated, and Knox says some things here that I think help you get a sense of this. This is one of Knox's prayers about the Anglican Church, not about the Catholic Church. Okay, just get this straight. This is the Anglican Church. This is while he's in England. He can't go back to Scotland because they'll kill him. The Queen Regent is still in charge. And he says, "O God Eternal, hast Thou laid none other burden upon our backs than Jesus laid by His word? Then, which His burden is light, His yoke is easy, and His burden is light. Jesus carried all of it. That's understatement. You know." There is no burden. Jesus lifted it. He carried all of it. Then who hath burdened us with all these ceremonies prescribed? Here's a summary of how Catholic the Anglican Church still was. All these ceremonies prescribed fasting, compelled chastity, unlawful vows, invocations of saints with the idolatry of the Mass. You know, Cranmer gets a little offended when you call it the idolatry of the Mass. And it's supposed to be now Protestant, you know, England. And what's going on to Knox? Nothing's changed. You can change the names and have this act of uniformity and all, but it's still the idolatry of the Mass. We're worshiping something else than Jesus in that. The devil, brethren, says, can you imagine you're at All Hallows Bread Street or you're preaching at Westminster Abbey and Cranmer's over there. Would somebody shut this guy up? You know, we can't ship him off to Scotland because they'll kill him, but, you know, and we like him, but, got to find another place for him here. The devil, brethren, invented all these birds to depress imprudent men to perdition. Perdition means ruin. Gives you a real flavor of Knox and where he's going. So this inconvenience, they're looking around. Where's a pulpit we could send Knox to? Still in England, you know. And they discover one. And it's, I don't know, I don't know Fayetteville real well. I can get from here to the Fairfield Inn, you know, real well. I can figure that out now. But I suspect that you have neighborhoods in Fayetteville that are ones that you need to be praying about every day and concerned about. We do in my community, and it's called Tillicum, which is an old coastal Indian name. And Tillicum is the town. It's a town right next to a joint base, Lewis McChord. Some of you know that area. Maybe you've been stationed there along the way. I don't know. But and it has some of the most, I mean, it's got highest levels of prostitution and drug use. The little school that's there, a good friend of mine, it has an outreach to that school, Tillicum Elementary School. The highest level of illiteracy in any school in the state of Washington. And more of those kids need a lunch or they have nothing to eat. More of them are living with one parent than the state average by a long shot in Tillicum. All of the fallout of worshiping ourselves and all of the fallout of being devout devotees to irreligious secularism, which the state of Washington, especially the coastal lowlands, Seattle, thank you, Seattle and King County, you know, it's so much of it comes from there. It's not just coffee, you know, and Microsoft. It's you know, Sin City as well. And the fallout happens at Tillicum. So I like to think of where they sent Knox as being sent to Tillicum. They sent him to Berwick-on-Tweed. Berwick-on-Tweed. Berwick is a, we had one of the English, we had an English woman on our Knox trip. And when I said Berwick-on-Tweed, she, excuse me, Douglas, we English call it Berwick. Excuse me, one of these, you know. But so I call it Berwick now. But Berwick upon Tweed, the Tweed being the river that used to be the dividing line between England and Scotland. And Knox goes up there, and it is a border garrison town. And Knox is, and you know, oftentimes garrison towns can have some rough edges. You know, if you've been stationed in various places around, I'm sure that's not true of Fayetteville, but, you know, in other places around, you know, you can have some roughness going on because it's a garrison town and all. Well, Berwick-on-Tweed is the, you know, augmentation of all of that. Bring all of the worst together and you got Berwick-on-Tweed. It was a rough place. There were mercenary troops. There were Poles. There were all kinds of, nothing against Poles, but there were mercenaries from all over that were, this wasn't home. You know, what I mean by that is men far from home, without wives, the restraining influence of wives and mothers, ain't good. It's very bad. And so Knox goes up there, and this is, you know, a muddy, cold, shivering border town with just all the fallout you can imagine. And he is assigned to be the chaplain to the garrison. And the garrison's headquarters was Norham Castle. And Norham Castle is... right there. That's the ruins of it now. And my group on the Knox 500 tour, at least some of them there, posing with that castle. So I want you to enter into that place. And the sister-in-law of the commander of the garrison, named Elizabeth Bowes, and her daughter, Marjorie Bowes, are there listening in to Knox preach. Sometimes he preached to the whole garrison, and other times he just preached to the commander and his immediate advisors and family members and all. And Knox is preaching the strength of Jesus Christ, the power of his resurrection. And he's calling people to repent. Knox didn't think that we needed to hypersophisticate the gospel, that we needed to try and sound intellectual or any of those things. He looked at his audience and he tried to connect with them about their great need. They were lost, and they needed to be rescued, and Jesus was their only rescuer, and they needed the power of the gospel. And so he preaches that, and his first two converts are Elizabeth Bowes and her daughter, Marjorie Bowes. And he preaches more, and there's something of a revival. Cranmer's listening, and he's only been up there a couple months, and we're getting these kinds of reports. We've got this town that was so rough and so ugly, and the power of the gospel. And it's just across the border. Knox is able to look across the Tweed into Scotland, his beloved Scotland. If he crosses the Tweed, the Queen Regent's got French soldiers up there to pop him off. But he's close, and he loves Scotland, and he wants to get there. That's the setup. Something happens next, and that is young Edward, push the wrong button, this is Edward being painted by Krennic, a German painter, or Hans Holbein, I'm sorry, who paints the classic Henry VIII painting. You know, you've seen it. And he paints Edward VI wearing much the same thing, quite a bit smaller size, and the same kinds of accoutrements and all, too. That's Edward VI. And Edward VI is now about 15, 16 years old, and he's sick. Exactly what disease he had. I know there's some doctors in the room. I'm not sure. I don't know. The history I've read, they make speculation about it, but he is not slated for long life. And perhaps by the Spirit of God's work, that was being used to help him get perspective on his life and to be a deeply committed young Christian man. He dies. They scramble what are we going to do? This is Protestant England, right? We need to get, well, let's get this cousin of Edward's, you know, whose grandfather was Henry the VII, and let's get little Lady Jane Grey here. She's an earnest Christian and very articulate about believing in Jesus, and she can argue with the best of the Roman Catholic priests around eventually, and they prop her up, queen for 9 days. You've heard that story. And then who comes from Spain? Mary. Mary Tudor, Mary the First, another Mary, but we have to consider her. We'll call her Bloody Mary from here on out, okay? That's not what her mother named her, but history names her that for good reasons. Knox tells us what it's like when he gets the word Edward's died. Knox genuinely grieves and sheds tears. He knew that young man. He cared deeply about that young man as a soul that God had chosen and Jesus had saved by the power of the gospel and the Spirit of God working in Edward's heart. And he rejoices. He's out of pain and he's in heaven, but things look grim for England. To Knox, they looked grim before. And now with Edward dead and the advisors around him and Bloody Mary on a boat with Spanish soldiers coming to England to take her right. Meanwhile, Elizabeth is wondering, oh my goodness, you know, he beheaded my mother, her father had. And now, you know, my half-sister's coming back who's very Spanish and very Roman Catholic. And I'm sort of in between Protestant. What's going to happen to me? Well, she's going to spend the next 5 years in the Tower of London, not exactly chained to the wall, but not able to leave at her whim either. Mary comes back, and Knox says, after the death of this most virtuous prince of whom the godless people of England... Sometimes, you know, Knox called a fig a fig. What did he mean by that? Was that intended to be an insult? No, he's looking at the Reformation in England, and he realizes there's sort of a declared we're Protestant, which for Henry meant I'm the head of the church and the Pope isn't. And that's about the only theological change that happened officially. And Cranmer doing the best he can under his circumstances and all. No, it was really largely a godless country. It was very different than what had happened in, say, Geneva or in Wittenberg. You know, the Reformation was very, or what was happening in Huguenot France. Oh, my. There wasn't really a revival happening in England at this point. Berwick-on-Tweed there is. Godless people in England, for the most part, were not worthy. Satan intended nothing less than that the light of Jesus Christ utterly to have been extinguished with the whole Isle of Britain. For after him was raised up in God's hot displeasure that idolatrous Jezebel, mischievous Mary of the Spaniards' blood, cruel persecutrix of God's people. Knox could spin that kind of stuff out without looking at his notes. You know, he was upset, and he knew what was going to happen. It's for statements like this, too, that Knox gets accused of being a misogynist. Knox didn't care if she was a male or female. It didn't matter to him. If you were setting up an idol instead of Jesus, Knox could string out that kind of vitriol at you because he didn't want anything to come in the way of Jesus Christ and him crucified and raised again. So Knox is in a dilemma because Bloody Mary's coming and she's got some scores to settle. She's upset. Her father, you know, divorced her mother, and it was in all the tabloids. It was public knowledge, being debated at Oxford and Cambridge, and you know all of that. She can't forget all of that, and she also is determined to get the people that were most responsible, as she saw it, for that divorce and for the turning of England over to a king as the head of the church instead of the Pope. And that would be Cranmer, as she saw it, Ridley and Latimer, and about almost 300 other pastors and leaders in the church. Knox would be among them, sort of by default, because he's there and he's with them. So Knox's advisor, Knox had no intention of leaving. He was not the kind of guy to go to flee. You know, flight was not in his job description as he saw it being given to him by Jesus Christ himself. And but his the people around him said, Knox, I know that Berwick-on-Tweed is a long ways from London and she's working the territory in London and she's going to come up here eventually. All she has to do is send a dispatch up to Norham Castle and have the garrison order you to be put in chains. They'll put you on a coach and send you down to London, and you will be burning at the stake. It's going to happen. And Knox says, I don't really care about that. I don't care about my wretched life, he called it. I'm here preaching the gospel. I have a ministry. Well, they finally almost physically had to package him up and stuff him in a boat and get him across the North Sea to a refugee center in Europe, which would be largely Geneva. And Knox would spend most of the next 5 years with a little flurry in the middle, I'll tell you about in a moment. That was pretty amazing. And he feels guilty about this. He really labors. He thinks, I abandoned my post. And there's some things that are going to happen a little while later to some of his dear friends that are going to make him really feel bad about this. But God in his providence had Knox sitting under Calvin's ministry. And Knox would go on and he would call this ministry, and I wish, now I want to go into this excursus about Calvin for the next 4 days, but I won't do that. You can read about that in the betrayal and also in the thunder, because there's this overlapping episode that happens from two different points of view in this time, and you'll meet Knox in the betrayal as well. But Knox would come back from Geneva. The Reformation wall wasn't there then, just so you know. That was the 400th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, of the birth of John Calvin, in fact, in 1909 on the city wall, the old town, the Centreville, where all of the Reformation took place then. Geneva has spread out since then. And that was unveiled in 1909 on July 10th. 1909. But Knox would say of Geneva, he said it was the most perfect school of Christ on earth since the days of the apostles. And that wasn't just Knox's opinion. Geneva would go on to be called a haven for women. They didn't have to go drag people into the way you hear about Geneva. You'd think that they were dragging people into Geneva. You have to stay here under the cruelties of John Calvin, you know, and maybe get burned at the stake tomorrow. You know, that's the way you would think Geneva was. It wasn't like that at all. They had people coming from all over Europe, Spanish, Portuguese, French, lots of French Huguenots, Scotland, England, and Italy, that were coming there for refuge. And it was a place of freedom. It was a place of the proclamation of the gospel. It was a place of economic freedom. The free enterprise happened there, and the economy flourished, and there were all kinds of new industries set up. There was even I said I wasn't going to talk about all this, but there was even a silk factory set up. Why? Because you had all of these people with various gifts and skills and experiences and resources. And they came into Geneva, and Geneva turned from being the Las Vegas the Atlantic City of the world, to being this glorious center of the freedom of the gospel, freedom in Jesus Christ. That's what was going on in Geneva. Knox honed his skills as a preacher there, listening to Calvin, having regular communication with John Calvin, becoming friends with John Calvin. And he worked on the Geneva Bible, which was not a French Bible, which we might think, because the primary language of Geneva, that's in the Canton Vaud of Switzerland, which is the French-speaking part of Switzerland. It had actually been part of France until just a few months before Calvin got there. And it had been part of Savoy in France, and it had been annexed. The people of Geneva had wanted it to move to Switzerland. So they became Swiss. But he works on the Geneva Bible. The Geneva Bible will have verses and chapters for the first time. And it will also have 300,000 commentary notes in the margin. It's the first study Bible. And Knox will have had a huge impact on writing those doctrines of grace, Christ-honoring notes in the margins of that Bible. He pastors a congregation of English refugees in Frankfurt for a while. He pastors in a safe place in France. There were safe places for Huguenots in Dieppe along the western coast of France, south of Calais. But all the while, Knox says, I feel a sob and a groan, willing that Christ Jesus might be preached in my native country, although it should be with the loss of my wretched life. And there again, God gave his spirit to simple men in great abundance. But he's getting messages. He's getting notes from Scotland and from Scottish nobles over there saying, we need you to come back. Can you come back? I know this isn't a good time. This is 1555 now. It's the worst time to come back because Mary, Bloody Mary, had kind of gotten her full head of steam now. First 2.5 years, she didn't actually burn very many people and all that. That all began midway about 1555. And they're saying, Knox, you need to come over here. And he's saying, well, you know, I was reading the newspaper. It's probably not the best. That wouldn't be Knox. That would be his advisors around him, his friends saying, Knox, don't do this. Don't go back there. And Knox will go back. Critical time, Peace of Augsburg in Germany, giving freedom to the German states to be Protestant in 55. And in 1555, Hugh Latimer, Nicholas Ridley, 6 months later, Thomas Cranmer would be burned at the stake in Oxford. Good way to remember English history, Reformation history, is Cambridge grew them, Oxford slew them. And that was happening, and he's hearing these reports about his dear friend Latimer burned at the stake, and his final words about God lighting such a candle that shall never be put out in England, just before they lit the torch set him ablaze. So Knox does go back, and he gets back to Scotland. He hasn't been in Scotland for a while, and he finds out that there are lots of supporters among the common people and among the nobility. The Queen Regent and her French troops want to kill him. The new archbishop, because, of course, Cardinal Beaton is dead now, the new archbishop has, before Knox even sets foot on the ground, the intel is out, and has put a hit out on him. If he preaches, shoot him. That was the word. And so Knox comes back, and he's there for a few months, and I call it a commando crusade. Knox is everywhere he goes, he is preaching, and he's being shot at, he's being hunted down, he's staying one step ahead of the henchmen, and there is revival in his wake. This is amazing. Calvin is going to send a letter. He says, I rejoice exceedingly that the gospel has made such rapid and happy progress among you. This is in a few months that Knox is there. Knox doesn't even, I mean, he's a simple, straightforward preacher. He's not some eloquent rock star celebrity pastor. He's just preaching Jesus. And everywhere he goes, and he's being shot at. And churches are actually being formed, and Christians are gathering. Knox goes on to the next church, and the French troops come in, and in Leith, a coastal town, port town, she goes in and she tells them to open fire on those Christians. There's what you read about in the papers with ISIS and all, it happened in Leith. A whole group of Christians coming out of the worship service in the days after Knox had been there and preached, and folks had fallen on their knees and repented, trusted Christ. She kills them, lays out a whole bunch of bodies in front of that church, men, women, children. It was ugly. It was not a good and pleasant time. But he came back for another reason, too. He goes down to Berwick-on-Tweed. He crosses the Tweed, and he proposes marriage to Marjorie Bowes, one of his first converts, and has to ask her mother because her father has died. And they get married, and he takes Marjorie Bowes then back to Geneva. After this flurry, this commando crusade there, Marjorie Bowes will have two little boys during the next 3 years in Geneva. And Calvin will get to know Marjorie Bowes really well because something's going to happen. And we're going to get our best description of Marjorie Bowes as a godly wife and mother and Christian woman from Calvin's pen. So we'll save the transition. We'll stop now and we'll transition to Knox poised and ready at the death of Bloody Mary to step back across the North Sea and come back for his final ministry and the last years of his life there in Geneva. Wish there was time for questions here, but I think you probably need to stand up, stretch your legs, and all, but we'll hopefully have some time for questions in sessions to come. Thanks for your attention. Take a breather, and we'll see you in a little bit.